Iraq's Fatah Alliance says it will continue to fight preliminary vote results and will not back down from protecting the ballots cast in Sunday's general elections. Russia says the U.S. policy of confrontation risks further degradation of ties between the two countries. And Iran sends a convoy of humanitarian aid to the northern Afghan city of Kunduz days after it was targeted by a deadly suicide attack. Hello everyone and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iraq's Fatah Alliance says it will continue to fight preliminary vote results and will not back down from protecting the ballots cast in Sunday's general elections.
We will not withdraw, we will not stand back, we will continue to defend your voices. This is for all our people, all our brothers and sisters who have run for the elections, the candidates, all those candidates that gave in objections and complaints from this election, first of all, in order to fight or defend the voices and the votes of our supporters, but also the votes of all the Iraqis.
Asadi said that there's confusion and lack of transparency in the announcement of the results, adding Alliance supports the country's high electoral commission, but will continue to file complaints and objections with regard to the vote outcome. Asadi also stressed the Alliance's rejection of the results is not in opposition to any political faction. Leader of the Fatah Alliance, Hadi al-Amiri, had earlier called the results fabricated and said he will reject them at whatever cost. According to initial results and reports, the Fatah suffered a decline from 48 to about a dozen seats in parliament. Senior cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's bloc expanded its grip with 73 of the assembly's 329 seats. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Baghdad, Wassam Bahrani, who updated us on Iraq's election results.
The Iraqi Electoral Commission, they acknowledged that there was disparities, that the new electronic voting system, it said the votes of 3,100 polling stations will be counted manually, which meant there was problems with 3,100 polling stations. That's also, you know, not a small margin. And it's also and then they will add that to the results. And as soon as they do, they will announce the final results. And we also heard earlier from the Electoral Commission that 6% of the electronic machines, because they're using electronic machines this time. And there was a lot of talk before the elections that should we, under the countries under occupation, should we go for an electronic? Is it time? Is Iraq ready to use an electronic voting machine? Should we not just use the papers and ballots? Because under an occupation, anything can happen. This this electronic voting system could have been subject to a hack, or you know, some kind of hack from foreign elements. So the final results will be announced after the appeals, and of which there have been many. After the complaints, of which there have been many, they will be announced. And if you talk to a lot of experts at the moment, they'll tell you that you'll see a different outcome and a different number of seats given to each alliance and each bloc.
Russia says the U.S. policy of confrontation risks further degradation of ties between the two countries. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov said that his country will retaliate against any hostile U.S. moves, but stressed that Moscow is now seeking an escalation of tensions. Ryabkov also called for lifting all restrictions imposed on the operation of Russian and American missions in a reciprocal move. He said bilateral talks on the matter have been useful, but have led to no breakthroughs. Washington also said there's no headway in negotiations aimed at resolving a dispute over the size and functioning of the two countries' embassies. Tensions have been running high between Russia and the U.S. over a range of issues, including the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Iran delivers a convoy of humanitarian aid to the northern Afghan city of Kunduz after it was targeted by a deadly Daesh-claimed bomb attack last week. The humanitarian assistance was sent to Afghanistan by plane. It includes food, medicine, and medical equipment, as well as a medical team. Iran's already condemned the bomb blast and expressed sympathy with the families of the victims. Attack targeted a Shia mosque as worshippers were offering Friday prayers. It killed dozens of people and injured scores of others. And survivors of the bomb attack on the Shia mosque in northern Afghan city of Kunduz recount the ordeal they went through on Friday.
On Friday, I witnessed a very tragic incident. I'm the prayer caller and was behind the imam. After calling the takbir for the Friday prayers, I heard a terrible sound, the first of its kind in 24 years of my life. I fell down and then stood up again, but I don't know what happened next. I just saw my injured leg and dragged myself to a window. I was afraid of a second explosion, so I and some others plunged out of the window. God willing, I see it my human and religious responsibilities to continue my duty like before. Those who are not humans and even worse than animals cannot separate us from God, mosque, and religion.
My friend went to the mosque a little earlier and occupied a seat in the left corner. I reached there and sat next to him. If it weren't for him and I was sitting in the middle of the mosque, I might not be alive now.
I'm happy that I survived, but many of my friends were martyred.
The Yemeni army says it's made significant gains in the province of Ma'arib, recapturing wide swaths of territory from foreign-backed militants. Earlier, we discussed this very issue with our guests in our news review program. Here it is. Spokesman for the Yemeni army has reported the liberation of another 600 square kilometers from Saudi-backed forces in the province of Ma'arib.
The operation of the Dawn of Victory, our forces were able to conduct very successful operations for all the factions and infantries. They were able to have support and they were successful in their operations.
Yeah, Yassari said the Yemeni armed forces are now inching closer to the provincial capital. He said 1,300 enemy forces were killed and 11 spy drones struck down in the operation. Yassari vowed the Yemeni army will continue operations to fully liberate areas under enemy control in the central province. Yassari added the Yemeni people remain steadfast in resisting aggression despite sanctions and blockade. He also stressed the Yemeni people will not forgive traitors fighting on the side of the aggressors. Saudi Arabia launched a deadly and devastating war on Yemen back in early 2015 to reinstate a Riyadh-friendly regime there. The Yemeni forces have been resisting the aggression and carrying out retaliatory attacks. Joining us now for the program is Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Sana'a and Yusuf Mowry, Yemeni journalist and political analyst, joining us from Detroit, Michigan. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Obviously, Yusuf, hope you're safe and well. We're going to start with you to get an update with respect to the recent gains made by the Yemeni army and what it all means. Yusuf, let me get an update from Abdul Latif real quick, and we'll come back to you. Let's get the latest from him, and then we'll talk about what he says. Go ahead, Abdul Latif. I apologize.
Thank you so much.
Give us the update first.
Thank you so much. 600 kilometers were liberated by the Yemeni army, and this is a vast area in the strategic Ma'arib. The Yemeni army managed to down at least 11 spy drones, and also the almost 1,300 fighters were killed. 4,300 fighters also were injured during the operation. The Saudi warplanes launched almost 1,000 air raid to support the forces on the ground, but they failed to keep the Yemeni army from advancing toward the city of Ma'arib. As we talk now, we received some news that the Yemeni army has completely liberated the whole province of or the whole district of Al Juba, and this is a major victory for the Yemeni army. The armed forces vowed that they will continue fighting and they will continue the military operations until they liberate the strategic province of Ma'arib from the Saudi-backed forces. This is a strategic province. It's an oil-rich province, and it is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in northern Yemen. As the Yemeni army, or if the Yemeni army managed to liberate this province from the Saudi-backed forces, then the northern Yemen will be liberated completely, and then the Yemeni army will start the operations, or began the operations toward the southern and eastern provinces of Yemen to liberate them from the Saudi and Emirati backed forces.
Thank you, Abdul Latif. And Yusuf, we had a technical difficulty there. I want to thank you for bearing with us. Your initial thoughts on this, Yusuf, you're saying?
Well, I think the West, along with Saudi Arabia and UAE, they were very familiar with the defeats that they have suffered on the ground. I think they're coming to the realization that they've lost the war. They've lost all battle fronts, whether that's in Mata province or in the province of Taiz, in the northern provinces. Wherever there's a battle, wherever there's an armed confrontation between Yemen's Ansar al-Allah movement and the Saudi-backed forces, Ansar al-Allah has been able to triumph, and they've been able to secure these strategic locations. Everyone, or most people who are not brainwashed by the Saudi propaganda and by mainstream Western media outlets, they knew that it was only a matter of time before the province of Madad falls to the control of Yemen's Ansar al-Allah movement. And now it seems that they've got the city of Madad surrounded from all corners, and the Yemen's Ansar al-Allah movement is giving the Hadi forces an ultimatum to surrender peacefully. They, you know, according to the military official, they can keep their weapons, they can keep their artillery vehicles, but they have the option, the choice to surrender peacefully so that no further blood is shed on the ground. What I can tell you, though, is, you know, it's not like the U.S. and the UAE and Saudi and the coalition forces did not realize or did not comprehend that this day would come forth. They are prepared for this. They're prepared to see the province of Madad fall. The strategic position of Western powers is not necessarily due to the plan B, and because they suffered on the ground, their plan B now is to surround Yemen with military bases. And this is the Western imperial agenda now for Yemen, is they figure if they can't control Yemen from within, if they can't secure a puppet regime that controls the affairs of the Yemeni people, then they will surround Yemen with military bases. And we've already seen the island of Saqatra occupied by UAE forces. We also see now the island of Ma'un, which is a very strategic location. The island of Ma'un is under the control of U.S. and UAE forces, who are building military bases and who are building military sites in preparation for perhaps a future invasion on Yemen. If they can't win the war on the ground from inside Yemen, then they're going to subjugate the Yemeni people to a strangling blockade on Yemen's economy. They're going to continue imposing these unjust sanctions on the Yemeni people. And ultimately, what they want to do is turn Yemen into another Gaza, just like the Israeli entity did to the Palestinians.
Gentlemen, thank you both. It's always a pleasure to check in with both of you. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Sana'a and Yusuf Mowry, their Yemeni journalist and political analyst, joining us from Detroit, Michigan. And that's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. International Monetary Fund says the coronavirus pandemic and inequitable vaccine distributions are worsening the economic divide and darkening prospects for developing countries.
Pandemic outbreaks in critical links of global supply chains have resulted in longer than expected supply disruptions, feeding inflation in many countries. The outlook for low-income developing countries has taken a turn for the worse. The downgrade also reflects more difficult near-term prospects for the advanced economy group, in part due to supply disruptions. Now, these divergences are a consequence of the great vaccine divide and large disparities in policy support. While over 60% of the population in advanced economies are fully vaccinated, and some are now receiving booster shots, about 96% of the population in low-income countries remain unvaccinated.
The IMF chief economist also warned that a prolonged pandemic downturn could reduce global GDP by a cumulative $5.3 trillion over the next 5 years. The IMF has predicted 5.9% growth output this year, which is lower than July's projection. It said advanced economies could regain their pre-pandemic trend next year and exceed it by 0.9% in 2024. However, in developing economies, excluding China, output is expected to remain 5.5% below the pre-pandemic forecast. Professor of Economics David Barkin says a wealthier nation's disregard for economic woes in third world countries could perpetuate the pandemic.
The IMF is trying to put actually a pretty face on what is a very dire situation worldwide. the lower growth rates that it is predicting are in fact just a symptom of the extraordinary degradation of international solidarity, the extraordinary, and I use the word again, lack of care for what is going on outside of the borders of each one of the richest countries in the world. And you have an implication of that, which is an extraordinarily troublesome implication, because it will mean greater suffering, but it also will mean the inability of the richer countries to really control the virus and the mutations of the virus, and the next round of epidemic that is going to occur from perhaps the third world.
The United Nations Children's Fund warns over 1,000 women and children in detention centers in Libya are at immediate risk. UN agencies said over 750 women and more than 250 children are among thousands of migrants recently imprisoned following mass arrests in Tripoli. It added that 5 unaccompanied children and at least 30 infants are among the detainees. Libyan officials began conducting sweeping raids in Tripoli, mostly targeting illegal migrants, earlier this month. According to rights groups, over 5,000 migrants are caught in violent mass arrests and are being kept in squalid conditions in Libya. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the United States of America produced 35.7 million tons of plastic waste in 2018, more than 90% of which was either landfilled or burned. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hannah Seo, writer. This article is published under the heading U.S. lags behind most of the world when it comes to plastic pollution regulation. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In recent years, countries across the globe have implemented laws to mitigate plastic production and pollution. In the past 2 years, nations like Sri Lanka and Belize have passed ambitious national laws to phase out a number of plastic products like bags, cutlery, and straws. But the U.S., a leading producer and consumer of plastics, remains woefully behind, even as it stands as one of the world's biggest polluters. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the country produced 35.7 million tons of plastic waste in 2018, more than 90% of which was either landfilled or burnt. The U.S. ranks second in the world in total plastic waste generated per year. In 2019, the U.S. also opted not to join the United Nations updated Basel Convention, a legally binding agreement aimed at preventing and minimizing plastic waste generation that was signed by about 182 other countries. More than 90 countries have established or have imminent plans to establish either bans or fees on single-use plastic bags or other products, according to data from the nonprofit ocean conservation organization Oceania. The U.S. is not one of them, though Americans have been aware of plastic pollution as an environmental concern as early as the mid-20th century. U.S. action against plastics has been piecemeal. The federal government has left it up to individual cities, counties, and states to decide whether and how to regulate plastics. The plastic problem is growing increasingly urgent. More than 1 million plastic bags are used every minute, with an average working life of only 15 minutes. Experts believe the ocean will contain 1 ton of plastic for every 3 tons of fish by 2025, and by 2050, more plastics than fish by weight. Not only does the ocean and all life reliant on it suffer from plastic pollution, but human health is also at risk. Microplastics have well-documented impacts on human health and have been found in 90% of bottled water and 83% of tap water. U.S. incessant plastic consumption is cultivated by throwaway culture, fueled by the plastic and oil and gas industry's efforts to sustain high plastic consumption while distracting people with recycling companies. However, a new proposed federal bill, the Break Free from Plastic Pollution Act, offers potential solutions and could transform the U.S. from a hindrance to the global movement against plastics into a much-needed ally. Such federal action could help stop the fractured approach to tackling plastics in the U.S. and shift the burden from consumers to plastic manufacturers. Advocates say even if the bill doesn't pass in full, its component parts, especially those that are more bipartisan, could likely peel off and be recycled into other legislation. For example, a part of the bill addressing plastic pellets or nurdles has already broken off and become its own piece of potential legislation, the Plastic Pellet Free Waters Act. Other countries not only produce less plastic than the United States of America, but they have also more successfully legislated against plastic pollution. Dozens of countries across Africa, Asia, and Central and South America have legislation in place to quash the single-use plastic crisis. Christy Levitt, the U.S. Plastic Campaign Director at Oceania, told EHN that the EU directive is just one example for the U.S. to emulate. Oceania has surveyed countries around the world, taking inventory of the global anti-plastic legislation and assessing where the U.S. sits comparatively, and found progressive policies in many pockets of the world. Chile passed what is, if not the most comparative, one of the most comprehensive single-use plastic foodware policies in the world, Levitt said. Beyond banning single-use bags and straws, Chile prohibits all eating establishments from providing single-use cutlery or containers. grocery and convenience stores must also display sell and take back refillable bottles, creating a cyclical system of bottle reuse. As early as 2002, the East African country Eritrea banned plastic bags in its capital city, Asmara. The country implemented a nationwide ban on the import, production, sale, or distribution of plastic bags in 2005. Rwanda banned plastic bags in 2008, and then all single-use plastics in 2019, with heavy fines and even jail time for anyone found importing, producing, selling, or using single-use plastic items. When countries across the globe with fewer resources than the U.S. successfully push out harmful plastic products, it gives the U.S. no excuse to be so behind. In the absence of national legislation in the U.S., local governments at the city, county, and state levels have regulated plastics. As a result, there is a diverse set of mandates and ordinances scattered across the country. One paper in the Journal of Environmental Policy and Planning says that as of August 2019, 8 U.S. states, 40 counties, and nearly 300 cities had adopted policies that either through a ban, fee, or combination thereof, aim to reduce the consumption of single-use plastic bags. To Rachel Cruz, a public administration researcher at the University of Kansas and author of the paper, it's curious to see such a large issue regulated to local governments. We tend to say that policy responses should be at scale or in proportion to policy problems, she told EHN. But local governments aren't at scale with climate change. Local governments aren't at scale with global plastics. And yet, in a lot of places in the U.S., that's where we are seeing the action happen, unquote.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic beliefs, and I'm your host, Musa al-Bahalili. Joining me in the studio today is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Our question today is as follows. The God of the Muslims, he orders the Muslims to waqtuluhum haythu thaqiftumuhum, meaning, and kill them wherever you find them, as written in the chapter Al-Baqarah of the Quran. Therefore, Islam and the Islamic God, he orders Muslims to murder. What do we say to this accusation, dear Sheikh?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, this is another question and another misconception which is rooted in taking, the verse out of context and taking into consideration few words of the Quran and ignoring other related verses and even the verses before and after this part of the Quran. Yes, Allah says that وَقْتُلُوكُمْ حَيْثُ ثَقِفْتُمُوكُمْ, and some people come to claim that Muslims are allowed to kill non-Muslims whenever they find them, because God says kill them.
Seemingly, yeah.
Yeah, seemingly. So first of all, we need to, as a kind of introduction, there is a kind of, we know that we have two types of jihad, fighting for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The one is called the initiative war, or al-jihadul ibtida'i, that is the, for example, Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, he starts the war, and the other one is the defensive war.
Right.
Non-Muslims attacks Muslims, and they just defend themselves. Now, all Muslims, they agree that initiative jihad is permitted at the time of the presence of the Prophet or an infallible Imam. But whether it happened in practice or not, it's a matter of discussion. Nowadays, many scholars believe that at the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, all the wars of the Prophet were defensive.
Right.
And one of the reasons that some people call them initiative war is the fact that they do not pay attention to what led the Prophet to come to fight, for example, the Jews or the Christians or the politics.
The circumstances of
that. Yeah. So, for example, when it comes to the Battle of Badr, it's not an initiative jihad at all. The properties of Muslims were confiscated by the pagans right. in Mecca. And the Prophet came to know that a caravan by Quraysh is passing by near the city of Medina. So he tried to, go to that caravan and just take some of the properties in exchange of those properties confiscated by the same people.
Right.
And then the Quraysh, they came to know about this plan, and they sent an army, and they began the war. And the same is true about, according to many scholars nowadays, true about all other battles at the time of the Prophet. He never began a war. Imam Hajar al-Salam, even in all his three battles, he told his companions that you have no right to begin the war. He tried his best to convince some of the people to, abandon fighting Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on Layl Ashura, although he was, besieged by so many, a great number of the enemies, again, he did not begin the war. He waited for the enemy to start the war.
And it was a defensive war.
Yeah. So the point is that when we research the history of Islam, we see that at the time of all the infallibles, none of them they have began a war. All of them they have been in the form of this defensive war. So now let's talk about these three verses, four verses of chapter Baqarah. We need to recite and analyze all of them to come to a true understanding of these verses.
Right.
Now, chapter Baqarah, the second chapter, verse 190 reads, and this is the most important verse, I believe, in this regard. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وَقَاتِلُوا فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ Fight in the way of Allah, who الَّذِينَ يُقَاتِلُونَكُمْ Those who fight you. So the point is that they have come to fight you, and now you have all right to defend yourself. I mean, for sure, when the enemy is the attack, Muslims, it's very illogical to wait Muslims just to stand still and wait
of
to be killed.
Not. Right.
So they need to defend themselves and also fight them back. So fight, but those people who fight you, but an ethical point. وَلَا تَعْتَدُوا Do not transgress. There are many narrations about the fact that Muslims are not allowed to transgress the limits in the war. They have no right to burn the trees. They have no right to kill the women or
right.
children or even elderly who have
unnecessary property damage, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. So although they have begun the war, and Muslims are defending themselves, still لا تعتدوا. You have no right to transgress the limits. إن الله لا يحب المعتدين. Allah does not like the transgressors. So this verse refers to two points. First of all, the enemies have begun the war. They have attacked Muslims, and Muslims are defending themselves. And second of all, Muslims should not transgress the limits.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. On IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. Now the next verse reads, وَقْتُلُوهُمْ حَيْثُ تَقِفْتُمُوهُمْ. Now you are in a practical war.
Right.
And so kill them wherever you meet them, you confront them. You are in the battle, they have attacked you. So, I mean, this is very logical for you to kill them.
Of course.
Otherwise, you will be killed by them. It's a fight. And then the Quran refers to some of the causes for, the fact that Muslims have the right to defend themselves. Quran refers to some of the wrong actions and oppressive actions by the pagans of the city of Mecca. وَأَخْرِجُوهُمْ مِنْ حَيْثُ أَخْرَجُوكُمْ. And expel them from where they expelled you. So first of all, they began to expel you, for example, from the city of Mecca.
Right.
The Muslims did not begin that. So you do that because they have done it before. وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَشَدُّ مِنَ الْقَاتْلِ. And fitna, or persecution or sedition, is graver than killing. Then the Quran says, وَلَا تُقَاتِلُوهُمْ عِنْدَ الْمَسْجِدِ الْحَرَامِ. Another condition. Do not fight them near the holy mosque, that is Masjid al-Haram in the city of Mecca, but حَتَّى يُقَاتِلُوكُمْ فِيهِ, unless they begin to fight you there. I mean, they do not respect Masjid al-Haram.
Right.
They begin fighting you near Masjid al-Haram. فَإِنْ قَاتَلُوكُمْ فَاقْتُلُوهُمْ. If they fight you there, then kill them. I mean, fight them back.
Of course.
Again,
you can't just let them kill you and you're just standing there.
كَذَلِكَ جَزَاءُ الْكَافِرِينَ. This is the recruitment of the faithless. Then the next verse refers to another point, which is very interesting. فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا. If they desist, although they have begun the war, and now you are fighting back, but then they stop war. Quran says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is all forgiving, all merciful. Very interesting. Although they have begun the war, but if they somehow submit or they desist, they do not continue the war, you also stop the war. And the last verse, وَقَاتَلُوكُمْ حَتَّى لَا تَكُونَ فِتْنَةً وَيَكُونَ الدِّينُ لِلَّهِ. Fight them until fitna is no more and the religion become for God. Again, فَإِنْ انْتَهَوْا. If they desist, if they stop fighting, فَلَا عُدْوَانَ إِلَّا عَلَى الظَّالِمِينَ. There shall be no, reprisal except against the wrongdoers.
So not only was this verse vastly taken out of context,
exactly,
but when you put it back into context, not only does it say that this is only in a defensive war, they also have rights, actually.
Yeah, that's
and
the point.
If they surrender, not even surrendering, it doesn't say surrender. If they stop fighting you, for various reasons, you must also stop fighting them.
And only a few people might be punished,
right,
like as Quran mentions, illa ala zalimin. We know
the war mongers, for example,
yeah,
or the leaders.
I mean, the leaders and the people who have killed some of the Muslims. So naturally,
right,
there might be some punishment for them, of course, unless they, submit themselves, which make them the prisoners of the war, and there are, certain Islamic laws for them. So the point is that when we see these verses and we take them and consider them in the context, we come to know that the Quran is not asking Muslims to fight these people just because they are disbelievers or
right,
just because they are politics.
That's not a criteria for
it's
fighting
them.
It's
not a criterion at all. Rather, it is because of the fact that قَاتَلُوكُمْ, they began the war. And Quran refers to some of the examples of their oppressions. For example, they expelled you out of the city of Mecca. So, to put it in a nutshell, although Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala asks Muslims to do jihad in this verse and other verses, but as I mentioned, practically speaking, it happened only in the defensive form. Second of all, Quran, although asks Muslims to fight them back, but refers to some ethical points, like not
right,
transgressing the limits, and then mentions that if you want to continue the war, it is provided that they also continue the war. and they continued their conspiracies against Muslims. But if there is no war from their side anymore, if there is no fitna anymore from their side, because sometimes they stop fighting, but secretly they are thinking for more fitna in the future. I mean, Muslims are not going to fool themselves and to be deceived by the enemies of Islam.
Or conspiracies,
yeah,
which they are making.
Conspiracies. So if there is a possibility of another fitna, for sure, I mean, Muslims have all the right, and I think nowadays all the people agree that in these cases people have all the
right
to defend themselves. So that is why the Quran only limits fighting the people who have begun the war with Muslims, and as I mentioned, not because they were disbelievers or pagans, rather because of the fact that they were the enemies of Islam.
And let us just again stress that it is not a cause to go to war with somebody because of their belief,
exactly.
Even if they were a polytheist, a pagan, or an infidel.
A Jewish, a Christian,
whatever they may be.
Any, I mean, example in the time of the Prophet or any other Imam that they have fought other people just because of their belief or their disbelief. There are other verses that I think we need to share in the following session.
Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time for today, but we are unfortunately up. I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Yet again, this has been your host Musa Al-Bahadi, and you had been listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Thank you for joining us.
ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نرقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا به. هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق والقرآن
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
According to the Palestinian Hydrology Group, PHG, Palestinians in the West Bank consume about 18 gallons of water per day. This is below the World Health Organization recommendation of 26 to 31 gallons of water daily to maintain a basic standard of living. By comparison, Israelis use about 80 gallons of water per day, and Zionist settlers may use up to 210 gallons daily. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jessica Boxbaum, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Water as a Weapon of War. Activists say Zionist regime is drawing out West Bank to drive out Palestinians. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Last weekend, around 600 Palestinian and international activists marched across Masafer Yatta in the occupied West Bank to deliver a water tanker to Palestinian villagers. Their message was clear. Water is a human right, and Israel is depriving Palestine of this basic necessity. Amid a sea of rippling Palestinian flags, demonstrators walked alongside a tractor transporting the water tanker from the village of Atawani. The protesters did not reach their intended destination. Instead, they turned back at the village of Mekkara in order to avoid a confrontation with the Zionist regime army waiting for them atop a nearby hill. Water is a right for everyone. It doesn't matter if you are black or white or Jewish or Arab. Adam Rabi, an activist with Combatants for Peace, CFP, one of the march's organizers, told Min Press News. Recently, CFP, along with other human rights organizations, submitted an urgent appeal to international bodies, demanding they pressure the Israeli regime to allow access to water to Palestinians living in Area C, the occupied West Bank area that includes Masafer Yatta. CFP started a water accessibility campaign for Palestine in August. In September, they led a field visit to Masafer Yatta for 20 diplomats from the European Union, the UK, Canada, Brazil, Mexico, and Switzerland. During the tour, CFP raised awareness of Palestine's water crisis and urged the representatives to engage in dialogue with the Zionist regime toward providing Palestinians with full access to water. Rabi said of the visit, "The diplomats saw families and children without water. My feeling is that they want to help and we have the support." Earlier in September, a CFP protest to deliver water to Palestinian communities was met with violence from Israeli regime troops. Six Israelis and two Palestinians were injured, including Rabi, who was hit in the stomach with a tear gas canister. Protesters had blown up images of the recent violence as they marched last weekend. In Makafra, the ground was strewn with shards of glass. Several of the villagers' cars were dented and the windshields shattered. Noma Hamada, a Palestinian shepherd living in Mekkara, picked up a tear gas canister off the ground outside his home. He said this was one of the 20 launched at the community with the army recently. He lifted his pants leg to reveal where he was hit with a rubber bullet. His daughter-in-law, Sabrin Hamada, said the army fired tear gas into their homes and settlers slashed the tires of their water tanker during the raid. Since last Tuesday, we didn't get water until today, Noma said, referring to the delivery of the new tanker from the activists. Hawat Mon is a notoriously violent, illegal settlement outpost adjacent to the Palestinian villages in Masafer Yatah. All of the Israeli regime settlements are illegal under international law, but legal under Israeli regime law. Outposts constructed without the Zionist regime authority are defined as illegal by both international and Israeli law. On days without water, Mekafra operates much like a commune. Noma said, "We usually borrow from each other, and when the water comes, we redivide the water." Sabrin described how household chores like washing dishes, doing laundry, and bathing the children are put off until water is replenished. "I have to put everything on hold until there is water," she told Min Press News. "I can't do anything until the water comes back." Sabrin receives 20 liters of water, about 5 gallons, costing 500 shekels from Atwani, where she sources water from a nearby aquifer. That same amount of water costs nearby Israeli settlers about 100 shekels or $30. Water is stored on a cistern servicing 10 people for domestic agricultural livestock use and may last between 2 to 4 days. The average American uses between 80 to 100 gallons of water per day for indoor use. This number doesn't account for outdoor water use, which for herding communities like Masafer Yatah is a significant portion of their water consumption. According to the Palestinian Hydrology Group, PHG, Palestinians in the West Bank consume about 18 gallons of water per day. This is below the World Health Organization recommendation of 26 to 31 gallons of water daily to maintain a basic standard of living. By comparison, Israelis use about 80 gallons of water per day, and Israeli settlers may use up to 210 gallons daily. When the Israeli regime occupied the West Bank and Gaza after the 1967 war, it took control of the area's water resources. This regime established pumping quotas and banned construction of new wells in the occupied territories. Mekorot, the Zionist regime's national water company, was put in charge of the occupied Palestinian territories' water in 1982. By 1986, pumping quotas were reduced by 10% for Palestinian wells, fostering greater water insecurity. In 1995, Oslo's second accord was portrayed as a turning point for water independence in Palestine. The Palestinian Water Authority, PWA, and Israeli-Palestinian Joint Water Committee were created, but the Zionist regime retained control of the flow and volume of water given to OPT. Despite the name, the PWC doesn't oversee water resources. Instead, its role is to distribute the limited water supply the Zionist regime provides. The agreement was supposed to last only 5 years, but remains in effect today. Until the initiative, 80% of the West Bank's water is for Israeli use, and 20% is for Palestinian use. Israelis also enjoy an unlimited supply of water, while Palestinians have their supply restricted. What was billed as a cooperative venture between Palestine and the Zionist regime is merely the occupation of water in disguise. There are no official meetings between the Palestinians and the Israelis because the Israelis don't consider us as a counterpart, Dr. Abdulrahman Al-Tamimi, PHG's director, said. The coordinator of government activities in the territory, COGAT, nonetheless told Min Press News that the Palestinian Authority is responsible for providing water to the West Bank and touted collaboration between these. Master programs are being promoted in the area of Judah and Samaria, West Bank, which will address the water supply until the years 2040 to 2050 to all populations in the area. We will note that these programs are being coordinated. Access to water in Area C is exacerbated by the Zionist regime's systematic policy of demolishing and confiscating water equipment and resources. Italian NGO We World reported nearly 10% of the buildings demolished by Israeli regime forces in 2020 were water, sanitation, and hygienic structures. CFP's statement said, "The military commander of the West Bank justifies these practices by saying that the Palestinian communities in Area C did not receive building permits. However, the Israeli regime's own policy does not allow Palestinians to obtain building permits in this area. At the same time, all the Israeli regime outposts and settlers who live in buildings without legal permits are allowed to connect to the water grid." For CFP's Rabbi, water deprivation in Area C highlights the severe discrimination the Zionist regime perpetuates. Rabbi says the Palestinian men can only get water 3 days a week, and then this illegal outpost next to it has running water. So it's just a very stark example of apartheid.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.